Okay. Everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net, KC2GS, I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KD2NVB, will be my co-host, operation into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among participants of this net. Hub maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages, and we also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website. It's an orange colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type into your browser, kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. We also have an EchoLink node available for use. Just point your EchoLink application to node kc2rc-r. The net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. All this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. As well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. A question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment, and address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NVB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any questions for future topics of interest, let us know either here or our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob, KD2NVB. Good
evening, everybody out there. Looking forward to a good, productive, fun net tonight. Back to you, Roy.
Okie dokie. Once again, I am AC2GS, and my name is Roy. And this is the KC Radio Club Technical Net. So, if you're out there and you have a question or a topic and give me your first name and your call sign.
AD2DU, Alex.
Okay, Alex recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down for tonight? Okay, maybe later on there'll be some more people. What can I do for you tonight, Alex?
Topical question, Roy. At one point, does unplugging your ungrounded antenna save it in a safety sense from lightning? And what happens if lightning strikes the antenna?
Okay, you're particularly noisy tonight, Alex. Is there any way to get a better signal? If you're using a handy talkie, maybe rotate its orientation. Not if you're indoors, closer to a window, because you're about 50-60% noise.
Is this any better on medium power instead of high power?
Unfortunately, it's just as noisy. That's odd.
I don't have an immediate solution to the noise. Questions about lightning.
82 to you. Okay, well, try again. Talk very slowly, and I'll see if I can pick out the question. The problem is that the noise is so bad that some of the words are obscured. So we'll try and give it to me slowly, and I'll see if I can figure out what the question is. Are you using a handy talkie? Well, what kind of antenna are you using, by the way?
It's a magnet mount outside. It may have tipped over or something. It shouldn't have a problem with noise like it does. 82 to you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, maybe it tipped over or something. It's really noisy. Unfortunately, even my co-host Bob is a little bit noisy. He's not full quieting as he usually is. So, you know, maybe propagation conditions aren't too good for some reason. The rain is getting involved in it. But try your best, Alex, and we'll see if I can figure it out.
So on the topic of lightning safety, like strikes of lightning, does unplugging the antenna render it safe if the antenna is not grounded? 82 to you.
Okay. It improves your chances a bit because if it isn't at ground potential, it doesn't attract the electrical charges as much as it would if it was connected to a good ground source, because lightning really likes to go to ground. It doesn't insure you 100%, but it improves it. That's why sometimes what a lot of hams will advise each other to do is, you know, in case there's a lightning storm coming, you take your coax cable and you just disconnect it entirely from, you know, your inside shack, which has electrical grounds and all kinds of fun ground potentials, and leave it as an open cable, weather shielded so it doesn't get wet, and you know, leave it outdoors. It's less likely to attract lightning because it isn't at anywhere near the ground potential that a lot of other things, especially in N, which is then grounded.
Does transmitting increase the potential of a strike?
No, transmitting isn't going to increase the potential of the strike. What the lightning is trying to do is get to ground potential as short and as quickly as humanly possible. Emitting radio waves in an antenna isn't going to affect that. It's, you know, the grounded portion of the antenna or near grounded portion of the antenna is going to be at the same potential. So no, it's not a great idea to do it when you have lightning because, you know, if your radio blows up and you're across the room, that's one thing. If you're sitting there with your finger on the trigger and you're talking on the radio and lightning goes into the box, that's a slightly different thing. So it's never a good practice to operate during a lightning storm. You know, whether or not you disconnect everything to be be steward against a lightning strike for discussion, but operating as lightning bolts are striking nearby, not a good idea.
Sounds good. I'll unplug it and figure out a more permanent solution later. I'm going to figure out my antenna. The only other question, if you want to kill some time and add it onto the question list, is what to do with an extra Raspberry Pi? Be it ham clock or something else. 82 to you.
Okay, I think we got time for that. Yeah, ham clock is probably one of the better things to do if you're so inclined and you have a display that you can use for that purpose. There are packages that can be installed in one fell swoop that install a lot of SDR software, and you plug in a one of those RTL SDR dongles, and you have an interesting suite of Raspberry-based SDR radio softwares. Other than those two things, I don't know of anything specific. That's certainly a hotspot is kind of the number one use that everyone Raspberry Pi. You need a top hat that is able to operate at radio frequencies. But those are about the three things that I can think of that people are using it a lot. I'm sure there's a lot of experimental amateur radio purposes. I'm sure people have turned it into somewhat overpriced keyers and maybe even hopefully Morse code decoders. But that would be an interesting thing to kind of look into. Maybe I could come up with something.
I think either probably the weather or a cool map. And I don't know whether I want to get into like downloading the maps from a satellite, but just current weather conditions or a neat map that I think is the key. But thanks for your help. I'll try to go fix my antenna. And listen in. 82 to you.
Okay, very good, Alex. I mean, those world map displays with DX information and such, I've seen them being sold for many, many years. They were even the age of Raspberry Pis. I don't remember how they configured them. It probably took a lot more technology. Now you can just install something, get yourself a relatively inexpensive LCD. I never felt a need for it since my shack has this big desktop computer with a bunch of screens. I feel that I can put up whatever thing I need to on the computer screen. I tend to use my Raspberry Pis to do with generic stuff like screening ad streams and blocking advertisements and checking on the speed and lag of internet connection and displaying it on a website. There's a whole bunch of internet kind of based Raspberry you can play with. This is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra AC2GS with this week's episode of the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone has, please feel free. Repeater's acting wonky. I don't know if it's the repeater or my computer. So if I have little gaps in my what I'm saying, please forgive. Anyway, AC2GS, anyone out there with any questions or topics?
This is Alpha Charlie 2 Zulu Victor checking in. Over Echo Link readings, or you a comment?
Say again, William. I only got the last piece of that.
This is Alpha Charlie 2, Zulu Victor checking in over Echo Link. I have a question and a couple of comments to share. So maybe, hopefully, this came through okay. I see the VU meter reading working properly.
Yeah, that came across perfectly, William. What's your question tonight?
Well, I wanted to go back to the lightning topic and the grounding topic because one of the things I found out during my career is that, you know, lightning ground is not a good RF ground. And so I think that's an interesting thing that we found out. And I just want to know, have you heard of instances like that?
Unfortunately, usually when we talk about ground, we say that there's really three different types of ground. There's electrical equipment ground, which is in your outlet, which is theoretically at the site that the power gets into your house, bonded to earth ground, but because of the nature of it, it makes all around be inside your walls, leaks current, and becomes far less of a true ground potential. Then there's RF ground, which is ultimately more a discussion of proper counterpoise or radials. Is a unbalanced antenna an opportunity to balance itself with some other conducting material? And then there's a true earth ground, where you would sort of want the best possible as far as lightning to dissipate it, because the best path to a true earth ground, the more likely the lightning will not make a right turn or a left turn into your house and cause a lot of your equipment to blow up. So the term ground, unfortunately, isn't as accurate as it would be nice if it were. It being three different phenomena that have different considerations. So, you know, people have electrical grounds so that they don't have ground loops, and other people have protection grounds, and other people have antenna grounds so that they have a proper counterpoise, a reasonably good impedance, and energy efficiency for resonant antennas.
Well, I had a lot of fun with that one year with AT&T and putting a satellite earth station on the top of one of their buildings in Washington, D.C. It's a long story, but we learned a lot. So if you want to hear it, or we'll go on to something else.
Well, yeah, if you can do it reasonably succinct, I would be interested.
A good contract to put a 7-meter antenna on top of the AT&T building. Everybody's worried about ground, and so everything is hooked up to everything, every which way. Everything is all hooked up to ground all over the place. The CAD welds onto the lightning protector system. There's a lightning protector on the top of the antenna with a special thing, because this is in somewhat of a lightning zone. It's the tallest building around, and there's other antennas on the roof, but this is a nice object, you know. And so all this stuff, there's a load frame. The load frame is CAD welded into the building system. They have these roll wires going down all around the building. And, so we put a shelter up there on top next to the antenna, and we tried to turn on the equipment. It turns out that nothing worked whatsoever. It was just so much RF sitting all over the equipment because everything was so well bonded together, and nothing worked. So they had to call in Bell Labs. Bell Labs came in and they investigated and they looked all around. And one of the big findings was is that there was lots of impedance within the overall ground system in different ways. And so there was like high impedance going down outside lightning conductors. And there was also high impedance in through the ground within the building. And so that all of the other ground things were wrong. One of the things they found lower impedance of was inside the rebar by the building, which is actually more dangerous, which is what they were trying to prevent. And so after lots of consternation, what I had to do was rip out the whole lightning protection system, put in, instead of braided cables going down eight stories, they actually put in almost solid, like eight conductor number two or number zero wire down along the outside all over the building in order to get it down to the proper ground potential, because there was too much RF upstairs. After they did that, it's quiet.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, one of the things, and the reason why people have problems when you start to ask, how can I ground my fifth story apartment, the matter of impedance. You have to understand that sometimes you're dealing with RF. RF treats a wire conductor somewhat as an inductor, and it produces an inductive reactance, which is an impedance, which is in ohms, and so it impedes the current going straight to ground the longer it is. Also has to do with dimensions. So, I'm a little confused about the braid. I would not recommend a braid for outside use of grounds. The weather conditions tend to corrode them, and they produce more problems than they're worth. They start to act as nonlinear mixers and produce a lot of harmonics. So I put my ground wire outdoors. Instead of using braid, I use braid internally because for short lengths it's very flexible. Longer lengths, I prefer using copper strapping. There are strips of copper, so they're not single wires. Single wires will have more inductance than a long, flat strip of copper going down. You could buy those anywhere from a half inch wide to 2 inches wide, and so the wider the thickness, the width, of the copper strapping, the less you're going to pick up impedance as your length increases. Even if you go past about 20 feet, you know, any kind of copper strapping is going to produce significant impedance. Occasionally, that's why some systems are floated without proper grounding, because the impedance would be so great that they feel that, you know, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. But yeah, you have to keep in mind that over extended lengths, you have to conductors that will the least amount of impedance per foot per year. And as far as I'm aware, that's where copper strapping shines.
With you on that and the strapping, because that's what they came up with, the whole thing with the skin effect and impedance and everything. So they did so many calculations. At one point, I think they said they were going to put bars all the way down the side of the building, and then there was this cost-effective trade-off. They certainly burnt a lot of computer power during those years. I got one other comment about that lightning protection system, and I think the thing to do would be to have a pair of dikes right there near the entry. If you don't have proper lightning protection, just keep a pair of dikes right there near the cable entry, and then just can run up there and cut it really fast, you know, when the lightning storm comes in. And then to get working again, you got to put connectors on that, and then now you have a proper place to disconnect the antenna when there's lightning storms.
Okay, I'm not quite sure what you mean by dikes. But, you know, many people have had many different ways of dealing with it. Again, the belt and suspenders, you know, really preventative guys will disconnect their coax cable before it goes into their shack and either leave it open or short it to an external ground bar of some kind so that it gives it a good path. Some people believe in giving it a good external path, and others believe in not really tempting fate anywhere near your house and to just leave it ungrounded, you know, whatever potential it is in the middle of the wall, building of the wall and such. So there are different philosophies. You know, most of the times in New York, though, there are so many taller structures. As far as I'm aware, although Long Island, there are areas of Long Island that are very high lightning. Brooklyn and Queens, as far as I'm aware, I don't really. Sometimes I'll hear people talk about how they got a lightning strike. It didn't affect their radio as much as it affected their utility, or you know the utility line. So you know things that were plugged in like a television set burnt out because of the lightning strike, and have been affected by anything you did on your antenna. So, you know, it's always good to be safe than sorry. You know, if you're living in the metropolitan area, there's a lot of downsides to urban living. One of the upsides is Ning has a much better path to go to ground than most of our antennas.
Well, Roy, I agree with you on that. Interestingly enough, we did get hit with lightning a few times up there on the roof. The whole strategy was that the entire room and antenna and everything were supposed to go up to the extremely high potential and come down together. So everything was bonded up there in the roof. So when the lightning hit, the entire earth station, whatever, went up to extremely high and came back down again, and everything kind of worked. It was just totally amazing. It had to do with these impedance paths, and the lightning just decided to take the lowest impedance and to skip the equipment altogether because it was like worth going there. So, you know, they really did a good job when they finished up. So thought that was a major accomplishment, and they saved my company because we may know what to do.
Yeah, AC2GS, by the way, it's always good practice. Usually lightning will simply follow least resistance to ground. Every so often, though, it can make a weird right or left turn. But you know you can't predict those types of things. So you go for a straight, very very low impedance path away from your equipment, away from your personnel, and hope for the best.
Agree with that. They even had us ground the door frames and anything that wasn't attached to the system that had all the equipment in it. So. Lots of fun learning things while you're on the job.
So, you know, many people would consider that an additional benefit of the job, you know, learning new skills and better understanding for things. You know, some people just, you know, treat, unfortunately, their job like they're the labor and go and do whatever, and you know they usually don't ask why. Ask why, usually you'll find at least one or two people who will take the time to explain it to you, and then you know then it's a much more productive time spent.
I wanted to clarify one thing. What I said about dikes was these are wire cutters that will be able to immediately cut the wire. Just leave them by the window. Wire cutters that'll do dikes as a slang word or something like that. That'll be able to easily cut any kind of transmission line in like less than a millisecond if you like clamp it down right away. Then you can buy new connectors, break, place to disconnect later.
Okay, that's what I assumed. I don't know. I kind of think it's probably better to just design easy disconnects. I don't use BNCs for that particular purpose. I have found BNC connectors to be very, very easy to connect and disconnect. I use them for my handy talkie. I get antennas that have bayonet BNC connectors, and I get an adapter, usually for SMAs, and it's very simple and painless. BNC connectors that I use inside the shack find it easier than using switches, because the type of switching that I need to do, I would need to have something like 5 switches with a whole bunch of different settings, and sometimes it's just a little bit easier to just disconnect them from their BNCs and them. All my wires are labeled, so I know what's going where.
Well, yeah, I was kind of wondering about the PL259 connectors and how useful they were. I don't know. It seems to me that what my situation is, I've already run the cable and there's no place. So, yeah, I'm going for is to have a loop of cable inside a place where I can disconnect it, throw it out the window. And then even though it loops inside and then goes back out the window, that's going to be fine, and I can always retrieve it. So anyway, I have plan A going right now. I've got the pair of cutters sitting up there in the window. But I think probably you're right. I should get some BNCs. I think that's the right way, because I'm thinking there of unscrewing PL259s. It's just never going to work. BNC sounds good, so I have to find the right size for my cable.
Yeah, that shouldn't be a problem. I think we talked about this before. Just make sure that they're 50-ohm terminals, because BNCs come in 75 and 50-ohm stations. HF connectors are used because they're used. If kind of restart time, most likely most people would end up using something more like an end connector. HF connectors have a couple of problems. They are not designed to be waterproof, which is important. And also, they're not actually designed to have a 50 ohm of impedance. Most UHF connectors tend to have 35 ohms of impedance through them. But because they're only running through them for an inch or less, they're not having any dramatic effect. One of the things that people get wrong, usually on 75 meters, is connect a whole bunch of UHF connectors in a row, loss of the connectors. Unless they're really broken connectors, good UHF connectors introduce a fraction of a decibel. So, you know, having 5 or 6 of them would be negligible. There's very, very, very little loss. They're not 50 ohm impedance and they're not waterproof. So fine, certainly with UHF and above, end connectors are de rigueur. We still use UHF for VHF and below. Again, primarily simply because that's what we've been using for so many years, and it's hard to break habits. But, you know, it does take a while to unscrew these things. So if you want something that can be disconnected in 2 seconds, a BNC bayonet mount will be the best in terms of disconnect time. That it's terribly waterproof either, but if you have the connectors inside your shack, that's not a real problem.
Hey, Roy, one thing I notice about the fact when you cut out is that it actually cuts out for a short amount of time, but doesn't lose continuity with what you're saying. So you'll be saying one word, and then it will go blank. It will pick up right where you were left off. So something is a buffer size limitation that's, you know, forwarding, but it seems to get all the words through.
Yeah, it's a buffer thing. I just have to. The problem is, as I increase the buffer length, I'm going to increase the delay of my audio. So I have to find a sweet spot. I tried playing around with priorities, task manager, and that works a little bit, but then it makes the rest of the system a little bit weird. So it's just a long-term matter of adjusting the buffer versus the latency issues.
Yeah, I think that maybe what's happening is that if you would talk to sure. catch you. And so then you would be talking, and then you would stop and then retransmit the next thing. Buffer would catch up. So, like if you would back out occasionally, like maybe, I don't know, it seems like it's happening after about 20 seconds. I didn't really time it or not. It seems like after a longer period of time, it kind of craps out. Maybe it'll even crap out on me if I keep talking long enough. I don't know. But then it picks up again at the next syllable, so it's really not a problem for people listening.
I guess it's a matter of tweaking it, and, you know, unfortunately, there's not a lot of great presentation of what nice settings are. There's a default setting, and then you can leave. It's an adjustment in the system setup box under performance, and it gives you an adjustable setting for network buffering and PC buffering. But again, there's not that much literature on you know, how to tweak them. So it's just a matter of moving the little pointers, and it helps it instead of hurts it.
I'm finding that there's a finite amount of time between the time I stop talking and the time that it actually seems to release the speech and allow you to start talking again. I think that's interesting. It seems like that's about 4 or 5 seconds.
Well, yeah, there's an inherent latency in any computer system. It's not quite that bad with EchoLink. It's terrible with IceCast. For people, when they're listening to the audio stream that I send out, you know, through the internet, 30 seconds latency before they hear us talk when we actually did the talking. So I'm thankful. EchoLink nodes are less latency bound. IceCast.
Actually, you say your last word like less latency bound than IceCast. Then there's a certain wait period. There's a click pop. Then boom. Seems like that's when it's released. So what's happening is it's kind of recording me and running the VU meter in my time. Then when I stop transmitting, it's like got the rest of the buffer that's in the delay, and then we hear the quick pop, and actually I'm done transmitting.
That's pretty much it. Also, it embeds its own little pause so that things don't collide with each other.
Yeah, that even happens in your transmissions, because I hear you, and I really can't respond. I hear the quick pop, then my transmit button lights up again.
Yeah, I mean, there's an inherent delay. If I finish my sentence and I unkey, that doesn't mean that the EchoLink doesn't let go of the radio. What you do is you get a pause, a second or two, then it will unlink, it'll turn off the transmit command from the radio. And until that happens, EchoLink let you transmit, because as far as it's concerned, it's busy. So if you look at the text window, it'll say that someone collided on the Echo node.
Okay, so I have another question for you. I don't know if anybody else has questions. They should butt in. My question is, I was looking at DX Engineering, and I called them up. What if I want to have, like, radio that's listening all over the place and another radio that's a transceiver line? And they said, you got to buy this thing that costs $99. And it basically protects the receiver, and you just put it in front of the receiver and it protects it. They didn't have like a switch that would work that would be off of the PTT switch on the transceiver. They said it just goes in line to the receiver and it automatically shuts itself down. Have you heard of those kind of things?
Yeah, it's a variation of a TR switch. I don't find it, unless you have your antennas very close together. We had this kind of conversation come up this Sunday, I believe, on the Limark TechNet. You shouldn't really have active antennas near field. You should try and put them at least a half a wavelength to a wavelength away into the far field. You do that, and you don't use a linear amplifier or anything. The amount of induced voltage in the other front ends is not usually going to destroy the front end. What you will probably have happen to you much more frequently, and it happens to me all the time, is that the receiver's front end the sensitivity drops. It's called desensing for you people out there. And what it sounds like is simply the noise floor goes up, because what happens is the gain for that frequency is limited. And so the signals go down and the noise goes up and you're being desensed. That usually only occurs during the time nearby antenna is transmitting RF. When you finish that conversation and you let go of the push to talk, the desensing fades very, very quickly, and you get your audio signal back the way it always is. A similar situation, I have two VHF antennas approximately 20, 30 feet away from each other. And, you know, one is listening to KC2RC. If there's something going on LimeWire that I'm recording and I'm streaming, because I stream both for LimeWire and Kings County, it'll radio using the Echolink node. So you can get these safety circuits that will sense RF and disconnect your receiver's antenna. It depends upon how dangerous you live as far as antennas and power supplies. I've never found it necessary to have that in line.
Well, I noticed the 10-meter net, radio making terrible noises when I was transmitting. I don't know if I blew out the front end of that or not, but that's what made me think of it. And quite frankly, I don't have enough property a wavelength away for another 10-meter antenna. So thinking that this kind of thing might be okay, like maybe it's an avalanche diode that'll just pin the energy coming into ground automatically the same way as passively than actively. So I'd rather that not have relays. So thinking this is a better solution. And maybe it has an avalanche diode, but then the guy I was talking to didn't know. So call back today, and you always get somebody new. So I'm going to figure this out, but maybe I blew out the radio. I don't know. It's weird. Anyway, control.
I hope you haven't blown out your front end. I would think if it was just a passive device, the simple way of discerning that would be that you wouldn't need a power supply. You know, very much an SWR meter, as long as you don't want the front be illuminated with a light, you don't really need the power supply. So that should be the giveaway. My guess is it's a bit more esoteric and it's an active device, but I could be wrong. I'm just making some assumptions. Most electrical equipment these days tend to be passive devices.
Well, I think it is a passive device. I put it in the shopping cart, and I'm deciding whether I'm going to spend $100 for it, and then I buy a new cheap radio for $100 to listen. But I'm thinking I've got to find a little radio that's got a waterfall display on the front. I think somebody was talking about Raspberry Pis earlier. My ham buddy's got one, which we can't find again, has a LCD top on it, SDR radio on top of a Raspberry Pi, and it's great. It has a waterfall you can dink on it. It's almost like DNA, but it's actually a receiver. It's not really a spectrum analyzer, but it has waterfall display and all this other cool stuff. So I'm looking for something that big, and in, he said he bought it for $100, but we can't find it again on the internet. We've been looking.
There's something that sounds a lot like that. It might be what you were talking about. It's very strange in that it's a Russian design, but I think basically the Chinese have just cloned it and sell them. And it seems to be a problem that it's one of those strange devices that need to be, the software needs to be unlocked. So the problem is as much to find a group that have the unlocking code software that isn't really related usually to the Chinese manufacturers of the hardware. I forget what it's called. There's a name for it. Something like Malachite or something. I would suggest you Google and eBay it and see what you got. The only problem is quality is kind of dicey. The Chinese will sell you inexpensive things, but a lot of times they won't work too well. So you basically playing a little gambling game. A little bit of Russian roulette, except you're not going to get a bullet in your head.
Yeah, I'm up for that. You know, I've already $100 on this radio, and it seems to work on other bands, and it works on FM, so I'm not sure I blew it out, but I can get nothing on 10 meters. Even after we were talking over the transceiver, I tried to pick up our conversation when I wasn't transmitting the other antenna, which used to work, and then it didn't pick up anything at all. So I'm not sure. Maybe there's different front ends for different frequency bands. You know, it's a pretty low-cost radio, though.
Yeah, I mean, different radios have different sensitivity at different bands. Some people prefer a front end that's wide open, so it gives you a good, reception over a wide frequency band, but the price that you pay is that it's much more sensitive to outer band transmissions and far more desensing. Usually, desensing is worse when there's another transmitter on the same band. But if you have a very wide open front end, be operating on VHF, and you may be listening on VHF and someone might be transmitting on UHF. There's a significant difference in frequencies, and yet because the front end is so wide open, it desense even at that. So again, everything's a compromise. The wider the front end reception, the more the chance of desensing problems.
Yep, I know all about that. One of the things we had to do sometimes is put in anti-radar from the front end of the low noise amplifiers on the antennas, because at airports you get blasts of frequencies that are just right below the band you're trying to receive on, and believe me, that doesn't work very well.
Yeah, the good thing about if you're having interference on a different band is it's relatively inexpensive to buy filters that will notch out UHF or HF or what have you. The big problem comes when you have someone nearby. Every so often I would doing the Limark TechNet, and my good neighbor Joe would be having a chat with someone on 520, and he would be desensing my reception. I couldn't hear anything. It's much more difficult when everything's going on the same band, because you need a much higher Q filter to get rid of the interference. And the high Q filters cost a lot more than low Q filters. A diplexer and such you can get for about $70-$80. Duplexer, which is very high Q, goes for thousands of dollars.
Well, I think we've beat up that subject enough. Haven't checked out the TechNet yet. Let's see if anybody's out there that wants to play.
Yes, indeed. This is AC2GS with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. And if you're out there and you got a question or a topic for discussion tonight, hit that push-to-talk button and say your piece.
KD2ZKD, Theo, I've got a question.
Very good. What's your question tonight?
Question regards power supplies. Switching power supplies are routinely described as noisy, and I've got a bunch of them because I've worked with computers here. And I'm trying to lower the noise in my shack, so I'm thinking about a linear supply. Do you guys have any opinions?
Hams always upon the type of switching power supply that you have. I mentioned that you're talking about computers. As far as I'm aware, low-end. Most high-end switching power supplies are reasonably good. I use switching power supplies lately. I don't have any linear power supplies. Are heavier, sufficient, bigger, and more expensive. So I buy high-quality switching supplies, and I haven't had any problem. I have a switching power supply that even has an adjustment so that you can change the frequency of its primary oscillators, so that if you theoretically see the noise spurs on your receiver and it's on a frequency that you want to work, pull a dial and shift it to the right or the left, which I've never had to do because I've never really seen much. I have a flex radio that has internal switching power supply components that sometimes produces little spurs here and there. So although you'll find the many old-timers who swear by linears and hate switching power supplies, a lot of modern-day hams pretty much only use them. Linear power supplies are very nice. Again, they're more expensive, they're heavier, and they're less efficient. But they certainly aren't going to produce any kind of noise. There's a lot of companies that manufacture. Astron, kind of the go-to manufacturer of both switching and non-switching linear power supplies. You probably can't go wrong if you buy one from them, but you know there are a lot of up-and-coming companies that manufacture power supplies. I have what's called a Tenma. I think that's another one of those Chinese manufacturers, but it's a good, high-quality switching power supply. I've used it for more than 10 years, problems. You know, there are others that are available. You can go to DX Engineering and take a look of what kind of things they sell. They usually sell good quality stuff.
Experience, have you had a problem with the noise, and is there a way to filter it that you guys know about?
Again, personally, I have not had a problem with noise. My wall warts are reasonably good quality, and they don't throw off noise. My power supply and my computers are quality, and I haven't seen them throw off noise. If you have something that's noisy, probably the best way is to just change it for a newer, better design, ultimately. But if you want to kind of fudge things and hedge things, you can surround it in metal or a shielded box or tin foil if you need a quick and dirty solution. Also, ferrites might help a little bit. They might kind of clamp out some of the RF, the hash generated at the power supply wiring or such. You know, most people kind of, if they get a power supply that's particularly noisy, it's kind of a sign that it's really poor quality, and they get replace them. I mean, that's sort of what I would do. Thankfully, I haven't really had a big problem, particularly noisy power supply in my shack or nearby. Every so often, people will be upset with RF in their shack. And you know, one of the simpler things you tend to tell people, put your radio on a battery and hit your circuit breaker. Remember that you're not the source for your RFI. Usually, you're not. And it's your neighbor. They have a fluorescent ballast that's producing it, or they have an inverter for a solar battery set up. You know, there are usual things that cause these problems, but I haven't really heard too many cases in the last 10 years problems with a decent quality switching power supply.
Thank you very much.
Welcome, and please come and participate again. You know where we are. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month at starting at 9 p.m. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. As long as I got you on the radio, William, can you tell me a couple of words how the VE exam went? I'm glad that he was able to get his general and Victor was able to get his general. But as long as you're with us tonight, if you could give me a little bit bird's eye view. I guess William stepped away from the radio. Once again, I am AC2GS Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone has any questions tonight or topics for discussion, feel free, hit that push to talk, and give me your first name and your call sign.
AC2ZV, checking in on the radio.
Okay, very good, William. I asked earlier, I guess you didn't hear, a couple of words on how the VE exam went. I'm glad it was a success. I'm glad that Todd got his general ticket and Victor got his general ticket. So it was a success that was had, so I just thought you might describe it a little bit.
Had, you know, three people. for the VE examiners and two candidates there. And they went through the test. It was like, you know, a very straightforward thing. The thing is, we didn't get started on time. So if people would do this again, people should be prepared for problems. There was transportation problems for a lot. Got stuck for a half an hour, and James got stuck. So everything kind of worked out. We got started around 3 o'clock, but we chit-chatted. Everything was fine, and we kind of knew they were coming because we were in contact to ZB. And basically, it was a nice afternoon, and we had to... couple people took two tests, and, you know, there was some confusion, but it got straightened out. And then one of the best things was that Berlot was able to learn from James about grading, and he's going to put everybody available so that everybody that's on the current list as DEs are going to be administrators. So each of you are all going to be administrators, so you'll have access to all the materials. And so he actually showed Berlot the keys to the kingdom, and he explained what kind of a hassle it was dealing with the systems, because they're not actually that user-friendly, and he had to jump through hoops to make this happen. So, hats off to James, because he was the guy that actually did all the work here.
Okay, very good, William. I do not think that James has the power to make everyone an administrator. He can list us on the online software, but unless the ARL recognizes us each as VE team leader, which they won't, I think they kind of want one person to be a team leader. That's as far as you can get. I was kind of involved in the background trying to get James the proper test sheets for the technicians exam, and it was an experience. And, you know, we're going to talk about it at our next general meeting going on forward, whether we see the future as in person or online. ARRL is really pushing online testing. And in many ways, it's very convenient as long as you have to have a computer with a camera and a microphone. Most people, I think, do have that. So it's you know, we'll be discussing it next Wednesday, most likely.
That sounds good. Anyway, interestingly enough, I'm getting worse reception over the radio than I was over the Echolink, and I'm wondering what's going on. It seems like there was an interfering, like hissing noise sound over your last transmission. I mean, you went down to 10 dB signal of noise and then back up again. So I'm just wondering, how is my signal? Is it okay into the repeater, or is there something up with my antenna here?
No, you're sounding fine right now.
The signal is recovered as well, so I don't know what that was, but it seems like that. I guess there's just noise that comes on the band from time to time from different people. It's almost like having to deal with spectrum communications when you're trying to get single channel per carrier through.
Well, I mean, it could be a lot of things. It could be something as simple as someone else was trying to transmit as I was transmitting, and it was just doubling, but they weren't enough to the repeater for you to discern an audio signal. So it just kind of put me, you know, it just raised my noise background.
Maybe that's what happened. I'm always interested in the dynamics of what that actually does when there's two signals coming in at the same place and how they interact. So that's an interesting subject, but not for tonight. I'm about done.
Okay. I mean, it's an aspect, actually, of modulation capturing, which works differently than amplitude modulation or, you know, single sideband, which is just another aspect of amplitude modulation. Amplitude modulation doesn't have capturing as a quality, whereas FM, you get to a certain level of frequency, the detectors lock on to you and pretty much to the exclusion of everyone else. But below that point, it's kind of open and adjustable. So FM mode interference is different than amplitude translation interference. So interesting topic for another night. Once again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 p.m. If you're out there and you got a question or a topic for discussion, otherwise we'll go to our little puzzle, but everyone an opportunity. If you got a question or a topic, please hit that push-to-talk button and give me your first name and your call sign.
Michael.
Hello, Michael.
I'm talking with my HT. I am signed into Echolink. I just got signed in today, but I'm not talking through it. I had a question about coax cable.
Okay, please tell me.
So, go like this. I was wondering why any length of coax cable doesn't effectively change the length of the antenna, so it changes the resonance. Meaning if I have, let's say, a half-wave antenna, why, if I connect a 10-foot coax, why doesn't that change the resonation of the antenna?
Okay, that's a very good question. Multiple layers of complication. It sort of also depends upon the antenna. The concept usually of a transmission line is that a transmission line does not radiate usually. If it does not radiate usually, then it does not add to the characteristics of the radiating antenna. So if you have a resonant antenna that has a input impedance of approximately 50 ohms, and you feed a 50 ohm impedance coaxial cable, if it's 1 foot, if it's 100 foot, feet, still the same 50 ohm impedance. Impedance does not change if the antenna is the same impedance. If you have a mistuned antenna, say 200 ohms, so it has a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio, all bets are off. Then as it travels down the coaxial cable, impedance of that 200 ohms will change. It will rotate around the same absolute value, but have different qualities because its phase angle, which is a part of impedance, changes. So if you have an antenna that's not resonant and you have an antenna tuner doesn't seem to be able to tune that antenna. Sometimes all that you need is to change the length of the transmission line, in some cases as little as 3-4 feet, and it will rotate the impedance and allow that antenna tuner to tune. I once had a 10-meter that would not tune. I put a 3-foot jumper between it and my antenna tuner, and I was then able to tune it. Also, let me drop for a second. Okay. Also, I always advise people when they're putting up things like center-fed dipoles, which are called balanced antennas, if they're going to use a transmission line like a coax, which almost everyone does, as the simplest way of doing things, coaxial cable is an unbalanced transmission line. In the case of an unbalanced transmission line feeding a balanced antenna, reflection where the transmission line does in fact act like part of the antenna system. Very recently, I was dealing with a situation. A gentleman had a center-fed dipole, was fed by a transmission line, but it was acting as though it was a lot longer than it should have been. That was because it was going down the transmission line and radiating like an off-center fed Wyndham rather than the center fed. So when I told him to put an RF choke at the feed point, we'll block common mode external radiating energy. Once again, it acts like a standard center-fed dipole, and the length of the transmission line doesn't have an effect. I hope I haven't confused you here.
That was very helpful. I can't say I understood all of this, but thank you.
You're welcome, Michael. Anytime. We're here the second and fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 p.m.
Thank you.
You're very, very noisy. If you're using a handy talkie, sometimes if you change the orientation of the antenna, it's now vertical, try it horizontal. If that doesn't work, bring it closer to the window, because your noise, your percentage noise went up to about 90% now. Nope, that didn't help. Actually, it less of a signal to the repeater. It dropped your signal. So I don't know what to tell you, but I understood what you said before, but right now it's mostly just noise.
Okay, this is the Echo Link. How's that coming in?
That is incredibly better. You're sitting next to me here.
Okay, so maybe that's appropriate, because my question was, in general, what do, I'm fairly new, what do hams think about Echolink? Is it some sort of cheating, or is it like, a comfortable way? I don't know.
Well, you gotta understand, hams are like are human beings, and so different people have different opinions. There are guys out there who have clipboards and checks, what's really ham radio, what isn't ham radio. And I usually tell a joke that if they didn't make spark gap transmitters, which were very popular in the 20th century, illegal, because they generate a lot of noise, and they're really a terrible design. They were very crude devices prior to the development of vacuum tubes. If they didn't make it illegal, there would be a group of people who said that the only true hams are those who transmit on spark gaps. So, yes, you will come across people who, if there is anything to do with internet, any portion of your transmissions or the internet, they will poo-poo it. Some will give you an okay because it's part of the way you're going into the repeater or into my shack via the internet, but then you're going through RF of my radio. So part of your pathway is radio frequency. So some guys will give you an okay on that, and others won't. You just got to find what works for you, and try not to listen to people telling you whether or not you're an amateur radio operator. License in my eyes and many other eyes. So, you know, there are people who enjoy using digital radios and hotspots. So it becomes a much more vague thing, because RF link is in their house because their hotspot is in their house, and the hotspot's connected to their internet provider. It goes all the way to the other guy's internet provider, and the other guy, hotspot that has local RF in his house, picking up the radio waves from, 3 feet away. So, everyone has their opinion, but if you enjoy doing it, it's fine as far as I'm concerned, and many, reasonable people out there.
Okay, thank you very much. Sorry about my doubling over there. Thank you very much, explained a lot. You're my first person I talked to, so thank you.
Okay, very good. Like I said, we're here second and fourth Wednesdays. So you could get us on RF. You can get us on Echolink. Just so happens the first ham conversation that I personally had when I got my license, I did not have any antennas. I did not have any radios. Pretty much had was my iPhone. So I got approved for Echolink, and I connected to a nearby repeater, and I had a conversation with a guy who used the same method to link to that repeater in Romania. So my first conversation as a licensed amateur radio operator was with a Romanian ham using Echolink and my iPhone.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, don't be a stranger, Michael, and thank you for participating tonight. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So if you're out there and you got any kind of question or topic before our puzzle, please hit that push to talk button and give us your first name and your call sign. Okay, I guess we'll go to our puzzle. This is an illustration, so you would have to kind of take a quick look Again, you could either go to the front page of our club's website, www.kc2r, someplace, I think, in the middle. It mentions the puzzle for tonight in orange-colored font, and you click it on it. It'll take you to your browser, www.kc2rc.com, and that should bring you to the same exact link. So it's an illustration, very simple, basically two diodes that are parallel and in opposite orientations. So the cathode and the anode reversed on one from the other, and it's a parallel connection. A lot of times they call that an anti-parallel pair of diodes. And the question is, if the circuit shown here is inserted into the intermediate frequency path receiver, it will. Then you have four choices to choose from. Choice A is improve the sensitivity of your receiver. B is remove spikes of interference. C is decrease the bandwidth of the intermediate frequency. And choice D is prevent clunks in the loudspeaker at switch on. Would anyone like to hazard a guess of what's the best answer for tonight's TechNet puzzle? Hello there. Well, anyone want to hazard a guess? Once again, this is AC2GS with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net with a puzzle. I hope everyone didn't just kind of wander away. Once again, it's a picture of two parallel diodes in opposite orientation. And the big question is, why would you do such a thing? Does it improve sensitivity? Does it remove spikes? Does it decrease the bandwidth or prevent the power on kerchunk of a loudspeaker? So anyone want to guess? You got four chances, yeah, A, B, C, and D.
A-H-H.
Yes, Michael.
I'm not even by my computer, so I'm not looking at the picture, but I would guess B. Maybe because it resembles like a rectifier of some sort. I don't know. I'm really a newbie, so it's a really hazardous guess.
Okay, well, I appreciate it. I just want to make one more check if anyone else would like to hazard a guess, and then I'll try and explain it. It's not too difficult to get. But thank you for your answer, Michael, and we'll get back to that in a second. Anyone else want to hazard a guess out there?
Should be me.
Bob.
Honestly, I really don't have a clue, but could it be B, remove spikes of interference? And I didn't even hear what the previous guess was because it was all those letters that rhyme with each other. I couldn't even make out which one he said, but I'm just going to guess B. It's a total guess. Back to you.
Okay, very good. Yeah, he also chose B, and you're both right. I gather, as you mentioned, it's a guess. What's going on here is relatively simple. Because you have two diodes, the point is that the voltage drop of diodes is a relatively constant thing. For silicon diodes, it's approximately 0.6 volts. So if your diode is reverse biased, it's going to conduct no matter what the voltage is because it's going in the wrong direction. That's why they're an anti-parallel pair. In case, you know, the polarity is in the wrong direction, this little trick won't work. If you are biased in the right position, as long as the potential between the two is less than 0.6 volts, it won't conduct because the forward voltage drop of a silicon resistor is about 0.6 volts. So what this does is act as an emergency limiter. If the voltage potential gets higher than 0.6, it will get discharged. And so that's why, as both of you answered, it removes the spikes because the spikes are at higher voltage potentials. So that's where an anti-parallel pair of diodes are involved, and you choose what kind of diodes based upon the circuit need of how many fractions of a voltage you need to dissipate, which is above the specified voltage level of the circuit operating correctly. So answer is B. It removes spikes of interference by the nature of a forward biased diode's voltage drop. Okay, any other questions or comments before we start shutting down the net for tonight?
K2NVB.
Yes, Bob, I just got the end of your transmission.
Oh, all I said was by call sign, so I guess I pressed the button, didn't wait long enough. I don't know if it's appropriate. I just got a new iPhone. I actually got the 14 Max, Pro Max. But it's like, this thing that says it shuts off battery charging at 80%, but it doesn't. And I've talked to Apple, and it's just so confusing. It's like all this complicated stuff, and I think, why can't the darn thing just shut off the voltage at 80% and be done with it, not have to track anything about your usage and all? Anyway, or if there's a way to do that, because I have this charger that's so fast now, it's so easy to, I've done it twice in a row where I just forgot for a few minutes, and then the darn thing's at 100%. Back to you if you have any insight on that. This is just specific stuff for new iPhones, I guess.
Well, I have my old 13. Some machines are capable of doing it. They all have very smart charging chips built in. So I on my Lenovo's, because I've been burned more than a few times with the batteries just kind of dying and swelling, I have the operating system allows me to set it something like 87, 88%, that 82%, something in the 80s, and it seems to do it consistently. I don't know. It's really up to the guys at Apple, and they work in mysterious ways. One way that you can slow down the charging rate is by using a lower power power supply. If you have one of those old chargers that are rated for 5 watts, it will give you more than enough time to disconnect it. The problem is modern-day chargers are capable of a lot more watts of charging, and so they do it in a rapidly accelerating short time. So find yourself an old 5-watt charger someplace in your closet, in your drawers, and that will probably give you a lot more time to unplug it when you get to the magic percentage that you like.
Yeah, I did think of that. I do have an old charger for my old phone. And all I need is an adapter, which I think I got because I ordered this 10-foot cable and it came with it. The adapter, so it could get the new plugs with the USB-C instead of the big USB plug that my old phone had on that end of it. So I can do that. So I thought of that, yeah. The other thing I might just do is I know that approximately at 20% to 80% seems to charge in the neighborhood of a half an hour. I could just set the alarm if I'm in the room, you know, if I'm around. So, yeah, I see kludgy kind of solutions like that. Well, the slower charger is probably smart when I don't need to charge it fast. It might even be better for the battery. I don't know if it matters. I mean, they make these fast chargers, but I wonder if that's not good for the battery also. Back to you.
Yeah, all things being equal, the slower the charge, the better for the life of your battery. Lithium ion in most rechargeable batteries, heat is a detrimental thing. And the faster you charge it up, the more power you push through it, the more it has residual heat loss that heats up the battery chemistry. Although it might not be a dramatic improvement, a slower charge with a lower power wattage power supply will do less damage to your battery than these very, very quick, high wattage charges. They don't mention it much, but they do have an impact upon the lifespan of rechargeable batteries.
Okay, that sounds good. I think I'll go back to the slow one, just save the fast one for once, you know, like, you know, some situation where, I just need to get this phone charged and I don't have time and that kind of thing. Just have it there for those kind of situations. that would help. So, great. So thanks. Yeah, just for reminding me of those things. And the other thing was, I'm wondering if all batteries, like my camera batteries, you know, they're all lithium. They all should, I mean, I just have to have it just charging them all the way. Maybe I should be doing the same thing on all these batteries if I can find a way to do it. Because the cameras, I don't have any way to, like, know exactly how much they're charged. It's just that crude thing on the camera where it has about three different, you know, icon views of partially charged, fully charged, not charged. You know what I'm talking about. So back to you about that. I guess it's true with all these lithium batteries.
Yeah, it is, except that most people aren't really that involved with span of removable, disposable camera batteries and such. So there are smart charging chips, and they are on chargers. You'll what you already mentioned that you see in the camera, you'll get something like four batteries. And the first battery means it's a low, just beginning to charge. Three batteries in the image means that it's almost fully charged. It's not a very accurate assessment, unfortunately. Probably the best approach, if you can do it, is to be a little bit more reticent about recharging the batteries. What a lot of people do is, they'll top it off repeatedly. So, you know, anytime they're going to use it, if it's about, they get three bars or something, charge it up to the fourth bar. So it's more behavioral, unfortunately, than knowing when to unplug it, because, again, most of the chargers, consumer chargers, to my knowledge, do not have accurate enough indicators of its charge condition to rely on.
Yeah, my camera charger is they couldn't tell you when it's charged, which probably means 100%. And the thing I was talking about, the crude indicator, that's just on the camera, you know. In my case, it's just one battery, and it's either full or it's, there are only like three or maybe there's four different things, counting the one which is completely empty and counting the one that's completely full. There might only be one or two in between, so that's no good. Yeah, I went from one extreme of just always draining the battery all the way before charging it, and lately I've been topping it off, so I guess something in between is the best.
Well, I don't know necessarily if you have to completely discharge it, because it's going to put a little bit of stress on the battery as well. You know, batteries tend to like mediocrity. They probably perform best if you keep them no higher than three-quarters charged and no lower than one-quarter charged as best you can. So, I think if you discharge them completely, deep cycle them, it's going to accelerate their aging as well. So, six of one, half a dozen of the other.
That's what I was saying. I used to deep charge them, and then recently I've been going the other way, topping them off. So, I'll try to do something in between. And, but that said, all that abuse or whatever, I've been using the newest camera, of course, has newer batteries, but so I have switched to the newer camera. But before that, I had this camera that I used for about 7 years, or 6 or 7 years, as my main camera. And I was using the same batteries. Maybe they got worse and I didn't notice it, and they were still good enough for my purposes. I don't know. Anyway, back to you. Thanks, Roy, for that help on the batteries.
AC2GS. Well, you're welcome. A lot of times, long before they fail, what simply happens is their charge capacity gets lower and lower and lower without any kind of simple way of assessing it. It's just that you find yourself needing to recharge it more often than you used to. Times if they don't have thermal issues, and they die kind of with a whimper rather than with a bang.
Right, right. So my cameras, I don't know, when I do these things where I get paid to do some photography of the Harlem Chamber Players, but I always have spare batteries, that's the thing, and in that case, it's actually, I'm spreading it over anywhere between two and four cameras, because, you know, you don't want to be having to unscrew and screw lenses on, so I just save all my old cameras. I got five camera bodies, and I usually use about three or something on those jobs. So I'm spreading it over different things, and I got spare batteries on top of that, so it's never been an issue for me.
Yeah, it's always good to have extra batteries. They don't cost probably much that you need to have one and only. Whenever I buy anything like that, even if I buy a handy talkie, I pretty much always buy a second battery pack to be on the safe side. So it's always good to have extra batteries with cameras, certainly. I think I have more than a couple of batteries for my Sony. That's always good practice because, you know, you never want to run out of power. In the old days, we ran out of film. But now that we have high-capacity memory cards, that doesn't happen anymore unless you're really insane. You know, the limiting factor these days is the battery power.
Right, and I also use, especially with bigger lenses, I always use the battery grip. Just I like to have that extra grip, and it gives you two batteries on the camera, so, well, it's a spare, and it's, you don't even have to be changing it, so that's nice. I use those a lot, but not all the time. But when I don't, I have the extra battery in my pocket or something. Okay, back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. I remember using those when they were part of the auto winder function. You know, when there was real film in them. So you had a big fat battery and you had a motor. Those were fun. All those sound effects. I still kind of miss the click whir of the old SLRs, a motor attachment.
I never had one of those. I remember, you know, knowing about them and seeing them wherever I saw them in a catalog or whatever. I wasn't doing stuff in those days where I felt the need for one, but you have to change rolls of film very frequently.
Yeah, I think it was more of a toy for me. Because I like the noise of it. You know, I didn't use it that frequently. Because again, you were kind of stuck. You had a six images roll of film. If you kept a finger on the button, you went through the entire cartridge in about 20 seconds. So, you know, yeah, I don't know. It was just a toy. A lot of things are gadgets and toys.
People that shot sports or even what I do sometimes now is birds, especially trying to get flying birds, which is very difficult to get good shots of those, but I got the setting on my camera that can go 10 or 12 frames per second. Of course, I don't think those winders could go that fast, but, you know, try stuff in those days, you'd be changing film a lot, whatever level they could do it in those days. But I wasn't doing that stuff in those days. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I think the semi-professionals only got up to about 4 or 5 frames per second. The professional ones, Nikon and such, gave you a couple more frames. You know, I probably tried it on seagulls on the island. Seagulls, you would fly around. Every so often, they'd have the Blue Angels up there, and I would give it. I would use those that motor winder and such. But good old days. Anyway, any other closing comments before we call it a night? Very well, this net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Club is an ARRL affiliate. We meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be February 1st, which and it keeps dropping. We meet in person as well. We call it a kind of hybrid meeting. You can look it up on our website and find the location. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general club meeting can email me with some form of identification for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. Upon the number of points that are covered. We have weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater, and this technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 or roundabout upper sideband. We offer an audio stream of our Kings County Radio Club repeater, KC2RC, on the internet, as well as our 10-meter net. Just type into your browser stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club website. If you would like to contact the hosts of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate in it. Our website hosting services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens, so try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. It's time to roll this all up and shut it all down, but we'll be back February 8th to do it all over again, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, especially my co-host, Bob, KD2NVB. Without you guys, I would just be talking to myself. So, this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Until next time, guys, have a safe, easy week, and please consider joining us next Wednesday for our general meeting. Meeting, which begins at 7 on your local computer running a Zoom. Anyway, is AM clear?